From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The first and most important fact, Breonna Taylor was killed by police in her own home in Louisville. She had done nothing wrong, and now no one will be held accountable for her death. And within those facts opens up the sometimes giant canyon between law and justice. But maybe the canyon should not be so wide. Maybe justice is sometimes out of reach because of the law itself and how it is applied. And so in recent days, after a grand jury opted not to charge anyone for Taylor's death, questions keep emerging. What does newly obtained body cam footage show? What did Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron recommend to the grand jury? Why are members of that grand jury themselves upset with how Cameron portrayed their decision? All of which lead to the question, what needs to change for the law to deliver justice? Well, we'll begin today with Darcy Costello. She joins us from Louisville. She's the Metro Government reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Darcy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first of all, there is a lot of moving news on this. Can we start with the grand jury itself? You just reported a story, I think it came out yesterday, last night, about neighbors who say they did not hear police announce themselves near neighbors of Breonna Taylor. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So in the days since the grand jury indicted former detective Brett Hankison on three counts of wanton endangerment that were not for the death of Breonna Taylor, there have been a lot of questions about what specifically the grand jury considered and what evidence was presented by Daniel Cameron's office for the grand jury to consider. And he laid out in a Wednesday press conference sort of what his investigation had found and didn't release the sort of evidence or supporting records that led to those conclusions. Mm-hmm. But one of the conclusions that he mentioned was that a neighbor a civilian, he said, a witness to officers breaking down Breonna Taylor's door, had confirmed officers' statements that they announced their presence. And that's been a sort of question for many months. Like, did Breonna Taylor and her boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, know that it was police knocking outside the door? Mm-hmm. Because Kenneth Walker, who ultimately fired a shot as officers entered, says he didn't know it was police knocking. And so that's a big question. He was originally charged with attempted murder of a police officer. But, you know, if he, as attorneys claim, if he didn't know it was police, then that's kind of a more difficult charge.
Right.
And so we, as you said, reported yesterday that that witness, the civilian witness that Cameron said confirmed the officer's statements. We learned from some investigative records that we obtained that the witness originally in March told investigators that he did not hear police announce. And they called him back, I think, in April, and then called him back in May. And in May, he said that he heard police saying they were cops at the door. And so that just kind of, you know, adds to the questions that are surrounding the grand jury process. Like, did the grand jurors know that the witness had changed his statement? And it's one of, like I said, many questions surrounding this process.
That is so interesting, Darcy. So he was called back three times. And by the third time he was called back, that was when he said he had heard police announce themselves. Okay, so the question of what was the evidence presented to the grand jury is really bubbling up now. I want to play a moment from Daniel Cameron, the Kentucky Attorney General's press conference last week that you mentioned, and he talked about the facts, and here's what he said.
The decision before my office as the special prosecutor in this case was not to decide if the loss of Ms. Taylor's life was a tragedy. The answer to that question is unequivocally yes. My job as the special prosecutor in this case was to put emotions aside and investigate the facts to determine if criminal violations of state law resulted in the loss of Ms. Taylor's life.
That's Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron last week. So, Darcy, we've subsequently had the very unusual step of grand jurors themselves being upset with how AG Cameron depicted their decision, right? And at least one of them, through an attorney, filed a motion in court to have the grand jury recordings released to the public. First of all, when is that going to happen? And talk about why that's happened.
That's right. Last night, we obtained a copy of the motion that had been filed by an attorney for one of the grand jurors who has remained anonymous so far. And that grand juror was seeking in the motion to have the recordings and the transcript from the grand jury publicly released, and also wants the freedom for him or her, as well as other grand jurors, to talk about the process and what charges were not presented, what witnesses were not presented, and who was present and who wasn't present. They are basically saying to Cameron that everything should be made public, and they want to be able to speak freely about it so that the public understands sort of what the grand jury was considering, because that was sort of unclear after last Wednesday's press conference. A couple times Daniel Cameron was asked what the grand jury exactly considered, like, as in, did they ever consider charges for the two officers his investigation found actually struck Taylor? Those would be Sergeant Jonathan Mattingly and Detective Miles Cosgrove. And he didn't answer that question directly. He also didn't answer if the grand jury ever considered like a manslaughter charge, mm-hmm. if that's what his office presented them with.
Because the question there is, what did he specifically recommend to them, right? Because I think he characterized it as the grand jury made the decision not to bring charges against anyone specifically regarding Breonna Taylor's death.
Right. And it was sort of interesting. He said that his office had determined the two officers to fire back, Mattingly and Cosgrove, were acting in self-defense, and that the grand jury agreed with him. But then it wasn't clear if that was like a question exactly that the grand jury had been presented with or asked to consider. And actually last night in a statement after the grand juror's motion was filed, Cameron confirmed, in what I think was the first time, that the only recommended charges that the grand jury considered were the wanton endangerment charges, which was pretty newsworthy at the time.
Very, very. I mean, this is absolutely fascinating and disturbing, actually, that grand jury deliberations are always sealed. And here's a case in which a grand juror, him or herself, was so concerned by how their work was characterized that they're moving to unseal this. It tells us a lot about this question that we're going to be exploring this hour about the gap between the law and justice here. But there's one more sort of recent development that I want to go over with you, Darcy, and that is, I can't say newly released police body cam footage, but obtained body cam footage around the investigation, the immediate aftermath, I think, if I have that right, of Breonna Taylor's killing. What is that all about? What does it purport to show?
Sure. And I should say, just to quickly wrap up what we were talking about previously, in the statement last night, Cameron did say that his office intended to release the grand jury recordings tomorrow in response. He'd also been asked by a judge to produce that in the ongoing criminal case against Hankison. So he said that he's going to comply with that judge's order.
Okay.
But yes, as you said, the body cam footage was obtained by Vice News, I should say, who has done a great job here in Louisville. And it's part of the public integrity unit investigation that LMPD did and then turned over to Cameron's office and the FBI. And in one of the clips that Vice obtained, Hankison appears to enter Breonna Taylor's apartment after the shooting takes place. And he asks an officer inside about the shell casings on the ground and sort of what weapons were found in the apartment. It's a pretty short clip, but if in fact Hankison was entering the crime scene, that would be a big violation of LMPD policy because it specifically requires officers who are involved in police shootings to be separated in the aftermath and paired with another officer and sort of taken away from the active crime scene. And you hear the officer respond to Hankison in the body camera footage and says, like, back out until they get PIU in here, like the investigators who would be looking into the officer-involved shooting. And there's some other body camera footage that has sort of leaked onto social media in the days after the grand jury indictment. And one of them, you can hear an officer walk up to the door and say, like, is anybody in here dead? And then there's a couple other videos, but very short snippets sort of taken out of context. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to say what exactly they show. And we are actively seeking the PIU file. The Courier Journal has previously filed a lawsuit to obtain it. And I think as these sorts of pieces of evidence leak out, it's ratcheting up the pressure on the city and the police department to share these files.
Yeah. So we've got a minute to go before the break, Darcy. So how have members of the community been responding to all these developments in the past 24 or 48 hours?
Yeah, sure. So in Louisville, we've had more than 120 consecutive days of protest, and protesters here took to the streets and started marching like pretty immediately after the grand jury indictments, and have not given up on their mission to get to the truth of what happened. I think this process has raised a series of new questions. They'd originally called for officers to be charged, obviously, and now they're sort of shifting gears, talking about firing the officers or getting the grand jury transcript or holding city officials accountable. And so I think you just see lots of questions being asked from the community.
Well, Darcy Costello, stand by for just a moment. We are talking about the latest in the case around the police killing of Breonna Taylor and the question of what needs to change for law to better deliver justice. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the latest developments in the case of the police killing of Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky. And I'm joined today by Darcy Costello. She's Metro Government Reporter for the Louisville Courier Journal. And Darcy, if you could just hang in here with us for a few minutes and listen in with me as we hear now from Aaron Haynes, who is Editor-at-Large for The 19th, a nonprofit news organization that reports on gender, politics, and policy. She joins us from Philadelphia. Aaron, it's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much, Meghna. Good to be with you.
And also with us from Pittsburgh is Keisha Blaine. She's a professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University, and author of Set the World on Fire, Black Nationalist Women and the Global Struggle for Freedom, and the forthcoming Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Vision of America. Professor Blaine, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I wonder if I could just start by hearing from both of you sort of your thoughts and responses to all the developments that we have heard that Darcy laid out for us, that just even in the past 24 hours around this case. Aaron, let me start with you.
Well, first, let me just, give kudos to Darcy and everybody at the Courier Journal, support local journalism. They have been doing such important work to really lay out a case that so many people have felt at the very least was unfair and at most were thinking was criminal, even though, that is not necessarily how a grand jury saw what happened to Breonna Taylor. But I think that it is important to note, I've been writing about these cases since Trayvon Martin was on the ground in Ferguson and have seen enough of these, unfortunately, to know that you know, for many of these cases, justice does not often come for these families in a courtroom. It does not often come with arrests of officers or firing of officers or indictments of officers or convictions of officers. And so, you know, these civil settlements, Breonna Taylor's family obviously did get a $12 million settlement from the city of Louisville, and also some police reforms that were rolled into that settlement. These are some of the ways in which, you know, families are getting what the justice that they don't feel that they are getting through the legal process. Because, you know, what the activists have been telling me for at least the past 6 years is that the system is working the way that it was designed.
Right. So, Professor Blaine, same thought to you.
Just to echo what Aaron said, I think this part is so important to emphasize when we talk about the criminal justice system. I think some people often say that it's broken, but it's important to recognize that it's not broken because it actually is functioning the way it's supposed to, and that is to continually marginalize Black and Brown people, to continually ensure that they don't actually experience any kind of justice in these cases. I think a lot of people need to remember that very few officers are actually charged, and even fewer are convicted in these cases. And so, unfortunately, the outcome of the Breonna Taylor case is exactly what I think most of us expected, which is that no one would actually be directly charged with her killing. And then, of course, because no one's charged, then we can't even imagine the possibility of a conviction. And this is an unfortunate pattern, but it's reflective. And it's actually one of the reasons why police violence and police brutality continue to thrive in this country, because officers are able to kill, you know, unarmed Black people, and they continually get away with it. And so, not surprisingly, they keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. So to the question of, you know, what should justice look like? What steps need to be taken to get closer to justice in cases like this? I mean, I'm still stuck on what Darcy told us in the beginning of the show about about even the grand jury process and how, you know, the Kentucky AG said it's working the way it's supposed to, right? And we have questions there in terms of what was the testimony given to the grand jurors? What were the questions the grand jurors were asked to consider? You know, we heard Darcy talk to us about how one of the witnesses, a civilian, quote unquote civilian, was called back to do three different interviews with investigators. And by the third one, when this person changed their original testimony, was that the testimony that was offered to the grand jury? I mean, these are all the lack of transparency here around the grand jury process itself, I think, is one of the things that now people are increasingly saying, well, this is the way the system is designed, and it's going to keep justice potentially out of reach. Aaron?
Well, yeah, and I think that is why, you know, it's important to understand that none of these cases are happening in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. You know, it's never about one case. It is about all of these cases. It is about the entire system for the people that have been in the streets, not just this summer, but really over the past 6 years, calling for reforms to the criminal justice system overall so that there are not more Breonna Taylors, not more George Floyds, not more, you know, Rayshard Brooks's. Because you would have a system that is not skewed towards law enforcement. You know, as racial attitudes have changed around the idea of Black Lives Matter and the idea that police, not all police are good. Yes, the overwhelming majority of them are, but the idea, as President Trump says, for example, that we're just talking about a few bad apples, as opposed to systemic bias against Black people in this country in terms of policing, is something that has come about, I think, as a result of the ongoing awareness that, you know, these protesters and others have raised around this issue. And so you know, I think that continuing to have those conversations and continuing to push for reforms to the system and to look at this again in totality as opposed to an individual case is the way that, that this moves forward. But incremental change at this point, you know, I think is something that is has really frustrated a lot of people. People want structural overhaul of the institution of policing in America.
Yeah. I just want to make one note here because I think sometimes when I, I'm thinking through questions live and out loud, people come away with the wrong opinion. I'm not necessarily saying that grand jury deliberations should not be performed under seal, but we have on this show had people come on and talk about internal reforms to the grand jury process that they believe are long overdue to make it a more just and fair process. And I'll come back to that later in another show.
And this case has raised questions about the grand jury process, as have others.
Yeah. But so to the picture of to the question of policing and to your point, Aaron, about larger reforms, Darcy, can I just turn back to you for a second here because I want to fact check something. Did Louisville ban no-knock warrants a little earlier this year in the wake of Breonna Taylor's killing?
Yes, there was an ordinance passed called Breonna's Law that did ban no-knock warrants being executed by Louisville Metro Police moving forward. And it also set some additional requirements for body camera footage because that was a big point of contention that the officers who broke down Breonna Taylor's door were not recording on their body cameras.
Okay, so do... do activists, do people in Louisville, does the community see that as a significant step forward, or are they saying that it's sort of piecemeal?
Sure, that happened in Louisville back in I believe it was June, and protests have definitely still continued in the months since, and there is a Breonna's Law being proposed at the state level. So I think that's one thing protesters would like to see. But I definitely don't think that that is all of the police reform that local people would like to see. There's been a lot of changes in the police department and a lot of changes called for the police department to make beyond those no-knock warrants. Mm-hmm. But I do think that that was one of the really early on, one of the really contentious things about how no-knock warrants were dangerous and how a life shouldn't be worth just the seizure of drugs or money.
Mm. Professor Blaine, do you want to respond to that? Go ahead.
Well, one of the things that I would emphasize, which I think actually Ida B. Wells captured powerfully in 1893. And she said, those who commit the murders write the reports. And she was explaining, she made this particular statement to explain to people why lynching at the time just continued to, thrive in the United States. And people kept asking, how do we bring an end to this? So many Black people are dying this way. And we can't seem to find a resolution to the problem. And she pointed out to how the investigations were taking place. And I think in a similar vein, we have to be mindful of this. When I hear the discussions about the body cam, when I hear about the police officer stepping back into the apartment, asking questions and having another police officer give him a response in return, you know, it's a reminder of why these cases never actually result in anything tangible, because in the end, police officers commit these crimes, and they are crimes, and they should be called that. They kill unarmed Black people, and then other police officers are supposedly, right, helping the process of making sure that it's investigated. Well, let's figure this out. It's not so complicated. This has been happening for a very long time. This is the main reason why these officers keep getting off, because they cannot be the ones to be trusted. And as we just saw with the case of Cameron, we can't rely on the attorney general in Kentucky to do anything about it either. So all of these people come together. All of these people support each other. They protect each other. And they're hiding something. Clearly, they're hiding something. And we'll find out what that is soon enough.
So, Darcy, I want to turn back to you for a second, and then and Aaron, I'm going to hear from you as well. But to the point that Professor Blaine was just making, I'm looking again at the extraordinary reporting from the Courier-Journal, Darcy, and your colleague, Andrew Wolfson, 2 days ago, published a story that said, whose headline is, "Ballistics Don't Support A.G. Cameron's Claim That Breonna Taylor's Boyfriend Shot Officer," right? And then the lead is, "A Kentucky State Police Ballistics Report Does Not Support the Assertion That Kenneth Walker Shot a Louisville Police Officer the Night She Was Killed." Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, sure. So in Attorney General Daniel Cameron's press conference last week, he said that his investigation had ruled out that Sergeant Mattingly had been struck by friendly fire, because the three officers who fired their weapons carried .40 caliber handguns, and Walker had a 9mm. And he said, like, based on the bullet that they'd obtained, like, it wasn't friendly fire. But as you said, my colleague Andy got a copy of the KSP report that said the bullet was neither, quote, identified nor eliminated as having been fired, end quote, from Walker's gun. And additionally, an attorney for Walker claims that Hankison had a 9mm weapon. We haven't been able to get the records to back that up, but I think it's a valid question, sort of going along with what we've been talking about in terms of the evidence that was presented to the grand jury and the evidence that backed up Cameron's investigation. I think there's a lot of questions about how exactly he reached the findings that he did, and what exactly the grand jury knew as they were considering charges. Right.
Because just to be clear here, the reason why this is so important to get to the bottom of is, if I understand this correctly, one of the justifications that's been offered for the police shooting is that they felt that their safety was being threatened by this other gunshot. But now, as you're saying, the Kentucky State Police say that the ballistics cannot identify or eliminate that particular shot from having been fired from Breonna Taylor's boyfriend's gun. So just there's so many details here that I think continue to emphasize these questions that we're asking, Aaron. How do we get, when so much of the process, early process, is in fact, this is the way the law is. The police are doing the investigations of incidents that they are involved in. They are in control of all the information and the investigation. How do we get closer to justice for as long as this is the system?
Well, I think part of it is the old-fashioned journalism that is happening at outlets like the Courier-Journal. I think that one of the biggest things to come out of the Black Lives Matter movement is the idea that we cannot just accept what law enforcement tells us at face value, that the questioning of authority and pushing back against those narratives and that process is absolutely necessary. So, you know, pressing to get a transcript to back up what you hear, Attorney General Cameron saying his conclusions from the investigation, when we know that there were reporters who were on the ground, for instance, who were interviewing the neighbors in that apartment complex and came to a very different, you know, it was very difficult for them to find anyone who, you know, said that they had heard the police knocking and announcing themselves. And yet, you know, you hear the attorney general saying, you know, we found one person. Well, it turns out, as Darcy mentioned, that person had been interviewed three times before they said that they heard somebody. Or, the ballistics reports that tell a different story than the story that we heard Attorney General Cameron saying. And so I think that, beyond this grand jury decision, that you have journalists continuing to ask questions about this process and what it uncovers and what it tells us about the criminal justice system as a whole, I think is very, very important and very useful, to especially for people who are trying to make the case about what the holes are, why this is an unfair system for Black people in this country, and why changes need to be made so that so that Black people do feel that the criminal justice system in America is one that is also protecting and serving them.
Mm. Well, Darcy Costello, Metro government reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal, I know you've still got a lot of reporting ahead of you on this story, so thank you for taking some time out from your day to join us, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I should note, since we need to give credit where credit is due, the Courier-Journal also says that that ballistics report was first reported by Vice. So Aaron Haynes and Professor Keisha Blaine, stand by. We have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the latest developments in the case of the police shooting and killing of Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky, and what it will take to bring law closer to delivering justice in cases like this. I'm joined today by Keisha Blaine. She is a professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard, and author of Set the World on Fire, Black Nationalist Women and the Global Struggle for Freedom. She's also author of the forthcoming Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Vision of America. Erin Haynes is also with us. She's editor-at-large for The 19th, a news organization that reports on gender, politics, and policy. She interviewed Breonna Taylor's mother and sister in May, and I want to listen to a little bit of Tamika Palmer speaking to the public in September, on September 15th. This is Breonna Taylor's mother, and this was after the city of Louisville announced a $12 million settlement in the wrongful death of her daughter.
As significant as today is, it's only the beginning of getting full justice for Breonna. We must not lose focus on what the real job is. And with that being said, it's time to move forward with the criminal charges because she deserves that and much more. Her beautiful spirit and personality is working through all of us on the ground. So please continue to say her name, Breonna Taylor.
That's Tamika Palmer on September 15th. Erin, have you been able to be in touch with Tamika in the past couple of days?
I have not talked to the family again since Breonna Taylor's birthday, which was this summer, in which Tamika Palmer was still calling for justice for her daughter. That was still what she wanted at that time. And now it appears that at least at the state level, that's not something that's going to happen. Of course, we should mention that there still is an FBI investigation into whether Breonna Taylor's civil rights were violated. So don't know what the outcome of that investigation is or what the timing on that will be. But you know, unfortunately, Tamika Palmer and her family are now part of, you know, this group of grieving parents and family members who have lost loved ones tragically in this way and who have not been able to get justice through, you know, a criminal legal process, but are continuing to push for reforms at the local, state, and federal level so that this does not happen to other families. You know, I should also point out that, you know, one of the ways in which some of these communities have gotten what they feel is a modicum of justice is you know, politically. You had, I remember the DA in the Laquan McDonald case in Chicago, for example, or the DA in Michael Brown's case in Ferguson, both voted out of office because of their handling of those cases. People are already focused on Attorney General Cameron, who was elected in 2019 and who will be up for election again in just a few years. Will he be vulnerable as a result of the Breonna Taylor case? Is this a case that voters in that community are going to remember long beyond this year and this decision?
Mm. Well, so Professor Blaine, let me ask you, you know, Aaron's exactly right about nobody wants to become part of this group of parents who or family members who lose loved ones in this way. But you have done research, I believe, Professor Blaine, about how family members do, I don't know if become politicized is the right way of putting it, but how what their role is in cases like this.
Yes, I'm writing a book on this topic. And, you know, as we were talking as I was listening to Breonna Taylor's mom, I immediately thought of Gwen Carr, the mother of Eric Garner. I thought of Tamir Rice's mom. I thought of Trayvon Martin's mom. And even earlier, you know, I referenced Ida B. Wells and the campaign against lynching in the U.S. And I was thinking, too, about Emmett Till's mom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in 1955, losing her child, Mamie Till Bradley, losing her 14-year-old child to a senseless act of violence and having to spend the rest of her life truly fighting for justice, but even more so, trying to get people to join the movement to bring an end to lynching and specifically, in the broadest sense, white supremacist violence. And so what we do see is when these incidents occur, unfortunately, it changes the lives of relatives. And it if they weren't politicized before, if they weren't involved in any kind of activism, they do become politicized in these moments because they recognize that if they are going to actually obtain any kind of justice, it will be because of their actions. And that's true for the Breonna Taylor case. Let's not forget it's mm-hmm. her mom who filed the lawsuit in the first place, who got us even thinking about this case and talking about this case, her sister being vocal on social media. And they have made it possible, I think, for us to even be having this conversation. And it's painful to see just how history continues to repeat itself over and over.
Can I just say that when you mentioned Emmett Till's mother, that really just it got to me because immediately the images, right, that appeared in Jet Magazine, mm-hmm. because she made the decision she wanted the nation to see what had been done to her son. So she was put in a position of, in order to seek justice, she had to sort of make herself doubly and triply vulnerable, if I can put it that way, because her pain had to be made public through... No mother wants this to ever happen to their child and then to have tell the world, look. So, and you're right. And this is continuing to happen because, you know, Aaron, now we have the 21st century version of that when there's all of this, you know, all the video and the pictures of people dying that we're seeing that are, so it, essentially it's images of Black death that are required to continue to push people to action. And that there's something really challenging about that. I wish we could get past having to see images of Black death in order to really make meaningful changes in the system.
Well yes, Magna, but you know, unless and until you know, the rest of the country believes Black people and takes them at their word at the things that are part of the lived experience of Black folks in this country, proof is what is going to continue to be required, unfortunately. And that proof is deadly for the Black community. I just saw a recent poll, I believe it was out of Edelman, that showed, you know, the kind of support and attention around Black Lives Matter that had gone up over the summer, declined again because there wasn't another video to keep this front and center for people, to keep this front of mind for them, that this is a thing that is still happening in this country to Black people. But, you know, if you are a Black person, this is part of your lived experience. And so you don't need to keep seeing videos to know that it is true, to know that it is real, and to know that it is ongoing and something that feels very urgent and in need of address in a major way.
Yeah. Well, so in the case of Breonna Taylor, we also have a different kind of a set of different images too. She has appeared posthumously on the cover of O magazine. An image of her was on the cover of Vanity Fair. Professor Blaine, is that significant, or what is the significance of that?
Well, I think it's significant. You know, I'm always wary when it comes to these sort of symbolic expressions, because I think the challenge is that that many people are okay to settle for, you know, they settle for it and they say, well, look, she's on the cover of Vanity Fair and this is all lovely. So that means people understand the problem of police violence and specifically how it pertains to Black women's experiences. I think it's meaningful, but I think it has to lead to another step. And so people who are loving these beautiful portraits and images have to do more than just admire them. They now need to actually join the movement to bring about some radical changes in American policing. And I think that's when these images matter the most, is when they propel you to act. You know, if all you're doing is admiring and celebrating, then that's a problem.
And Magna, if I could just echo what Dr. Blaine is saying here, I think it's also important to provide a counterweight to the narratives that can somehow come out against these victims that in some ways may criminalize them or otherwise dehumanize them, even as they are the tragic victims who have lost their lives in this situation. I think about Breonna's sister Junia's Instagram account. There are so many images, videos of her sister smiling, laughing. You get a sense of her personality. You get a sense of the type of person that she was and the life that was lost. You know, talking about her, you know, hearing from Tamika about Breonna's, you know, just commitment to serving others in the medical profession, somebody that was literally in the midst of trying to save lives in the pandemic, and her mom being kind of more worried about her getting home safely and not catching coronavirus and not thinking that she also, in the midst of a pandemic, would have to worry about her being a victim of police violence, along with everything else that every other American is experiencing in this country in this moment, but that Black people cannot escape, even in the midst of a global public health crisis. So I do think that is the other part of the value of these kinds of images and you know, showing her smiling in addition to showing these other victims in their totality and focusing on their life, even as we focus on their death.
Yeah. So the way that the media and the national conversation around these individual human beings, to your point, Aaron, the sort of complex images that we see, I want to know a little bit more about what kind of a double-edged sword that is, because let me just set this up a little bit, because, for example, lots of very high profile Americans have been speaking out about this case. LeBron James, for example, shared in a very emotional tweet following the grand jury's decision last week. He wrote that he was devastated, hurt and mad, and he even elaborated in a post-game interview the following day.
We want justice, no matter, you know, how long it takes, even though it's been so many days, so many hours, so many minutes, for her family, for her community. I mean, I got a daughter of mine at home and a wife and my mom and so many, you know, predominant Black women in my life to, to think about if they weren't here the next day or you know, think if they were gunned down, it would be something I would never be able to forgive myself or forgive who did it.
So that was LeBron James on Thursday of last week. And just the day before, on Wednesday, Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron said this at his press conference.
There will be celebrities, influencers, and activists who, having never lived in Kentucky, will try to tell us how to feel, suggesting they understand the facts of this case and that they know our community and the Commonwealth better than we do. But they don't. Let's not give in to their attempts to influence our thinking or capture our emotions.
That's the Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron on Wednesday of last week. Professor Blaine, did you want to respond to that?
I don't know. I don't know what Cameron thought he was conveying with those words. You know, someone does not have to live in Kentucky at all. They don't even have to be in the United States to understand how this case has been just completely mishandled. And quite frankly, if you have a pulse today, that is the only prerequisite to be able to speak about the injustice that has taken place in the Breonna Taylor case. I think we are all united because of our common humanity. And I think it's unfortunate that Cameron used his platform to clearly throw shade, I think, towards LeBron James and others who are trying to use their platforms to demand justice for Breonna Taylor.
Yeah. So, Aaron, last question to you. To the point that both of you made earlier, the law is functioning as it's designed right now. But the question is it delivering justice? So how do you think this case has either changed or advanced the discourse around that fundamental question?
Well, I think one big way that it has changed the discourse is that it has raised the awareness around these issues happening to Black women. Mm-hmm. The Say Her Name campaign got so much more attention and awareness as a result of Breonna Taylor's death. I would also mention in the conversation around athletes using their platform, the WNBA dedicated their entire season to the cause of social justice. 67% of WNBA players are Black. And so, you know, they are also speaking from, you know, their lived experience. It's part of why they have Breonna Taylor's name on the backs of their jerseys and why, you know, you are seeing them continuing to push for change, even as they are in the midst of, you know, their playoff season. But yeah, I think that is really just kind of where we are as a country. But now women are much more part of this conversation in a way that they just haven't been nearly enough in the midst of all of this.
Aaron Haynes, editor-at-large for The 19th. Aaron, thank you as always for being with us.
Thank you.
And Keisha Blaine, professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh and fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard, author of Set the World on Fire, Black Nationalist Women and the Global Struggle for Freedom, and the forthcoming Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Vision of America. Professor Blaine, it has been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.